Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome, everyone, to Administrative Static. This is John Vecchione. I'm here, as always, with Mark Chenoweth. And we have a Supreme Court case has been issued last week.
They're always exciting this early in the term.
Oh, very exciting. Although I happen to enjoy this one because it's an original jurisdiction case. An original jurisdiction is when the Supreme Court has to take it because the states sue each other over something where the Constitution gives them the direct original jurisdiction, because the Supreme Court was sort of going to be there so that things that the states would normally, if they were independent states, you know, have wars over and do treaty rights with, would go to the Supreme Court. So this case is entitled Mississippi versus Tennessee. And for the first time, it dealt with an aquifer that that ran underneath a number of states. So it ran under eight states: Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Illinois, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, and Tennessee.
Big aquifer.
Yeah, called the Middle Claiborne Aquifer. And there is a Colorado hook on this. The Supreme Court first used the doctrine of equitable apportionment, which is that water rights, or sometimes fish that move in water, have to be equitably apportioned between the states. And they had done this for the first time in Kansas versus Colorado. In 1906, you will not be surprised, this had to do with Colorado River.
Stealing Kansas's water, yes, I'm familiar with the case. Oh, wait. Our Colorado audience may not see it that way.
Exactly. But that is exactly the attitude that I think everyone took. And there have been
this is with regard to water in the Arkansas River, by the way, for those who are unfamiliar with the pronunciation of the Arkansas River.
There you go. And so what's happened is, so the Supreme Court said, hey, look, water that we can't give the water that's in your state, because just like Mississippi here was claiming that all the water that's under Mississippi belongs to Mississippi. And even though Tennessee dug its wells straight down in Tennessee, when they took the water out, it created these cones, these depressions that lowered the water pressure and took and allowed water to flow into Tennessee from Mississippi. So Mississippi said, we own all the water under Mississippi and all the way up to the sky, and you guys can't be taking our water. But one of the interesting things about this is that the city of Memphis, this all took place around Memphis, and Memphis had been sued by Mississippi. Mississippi sued the city of Memphis saying it's taken too much water, and the case was dismissed. And the case was dismissed because they said Tennessee is a necessary party. So once they said that, Mississippi had to go sue Tennessee. And Tennessee said, no, we're just taking water out from our own ground. And they said, and Mississippi said, no, you're not. It flows over here and it's our water. So the court for the first time had to decide whether this equitable apportionment applies to aquifers that cross many states. And it makes a lot of sense that they came up with this ruling. But before they came up with this ruling, they did something that Supreme Court almost always does, which is in these original jurisdiction cases. It's an appellate court. And Mark and I, we always talk about what the standard of review is. And the standard of review in the Supreme Court is X, Y, or Z. And a lot of times for litigators, the standard of review pretty much tells you whether you're going to win or lose. But in these cases, there's no standard of review. The court has to do everything de novo, but they don't do it alone because they don't know how to find facts. So what they do is they appoint a special master. And sometimes they appoint a lawyer, and sometimes they appoint a judge. And in this case, they did. They appointed Judge Seiler of the Sixth Circuit to go over all the facts. Eugene E. Seiler of the Sixth Circuit.
And I believe he's in London, Kentucky, or at least he was when I clerked on the Sixth Circuit 20 years ago.
So he actually, an appellate court judge, was he ever a district court judge? Because he had to go.
I was just wondering that, because ordinarily, yeah, if you want somebody to find facts, you'd want somebody who had been a district court judge.
That's exactly it. But anyways, they say in here he ably exercised his job, and he produced a report. And so the report goes to the Supreme Court, and he says, here's all the facts, and here's what I think the law is. And the Supreme Court then looks at it totally new, and they can disagree with him. They normally don't go out and find new facts, however, but both Mississippi and Tennessee had exceptions. Mississippi's exception was, of course, it's our water. There's no equitable apportionment. And Tennessee had another objection, and that was this. The special master, Seiler, recommended that Mississippi be given a chance to amend its complaint because it had not pled equitable apportionment. And so they said they should be given another chance, and it should go back down. They should get another chance, and then come back, and then we do it again. And so the Supreme Court rejected all the objections, and also except for Tennessee's, because they decided, and this is a real bad thing, I think, for Mississippi. They said that they couldn't amend their complaint. So the case is dismissed, I think, with prejudice. So they can't come back and say equitably apportion us. Now, I may be reading that wrong, but they do reject that Mississippi can even do it. This says, finally, if Mississippi were to seek, so what they're saying is that they're not going to do it, but they can seek.
They, the Supreme Court, aren't going to do it, or?
Yeah, they're not going to. They say, as Mississippi had neither sought leave to amend nor tendered a proposed complaint seeking equitable apportionment, we have no occasion to determine how these and other pertinent principles might apply. So it says they dismissed the case. So
these
that
water cases often have multiple iterations. I
right.
know
so
Kansas it, it State, is. Colorado has several versions of it.
Keeps coming up, right? So yeah. So what they've said is that, yeah, you got to go back and start anew. They do not say you can't ever bring an apportionment claim. They just set out the rules for how the new case should be done as far as what they're going to claim, I think. So
Judge Seiler was a district judge, by the way. In fact, it says he was U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Kentucky and Western District of Kentucky. So I don't know if that means that either the source I'm looking at isn't a very good source, or it means that maybe the district split during the time that he was on the court. But anyway, from 1975 to 1991, he was a federal district court judge.
Oh, good. So that's
plenty of experience finding facts.
Lots of experience. So that is good. But and the fact is they one of the interesting things is that this is not a case where either side had bored into the other state's territory, because that's a no-no. The Supreme Court has said that you cannot do. But Mississippi had sued for $1 billion in damages. And so they don't get the $1 billion, and they've got to go start all over again. And I do think that it is interesting. This Kansas Colorado case, they cite it all throughout and say, hey, look, this is where we first determined it. So I don't know what they did before 1906. But the other thing is, as for their original jurisdiction, which is they say that we conduct an independent review of the record and assume the ultimate responsibility for deciding all matters. And that's Kansas versus Nebraska. And so if they want to, the Supreme Court can just go.
That was probably the Republican river if it was Kansas versus Nebraska.
Maybe. Now, I'm not sure. Or if it was water, I mean, maybe they fought over, you know what they.
Well, it could have been an aquifer there too. Yeah.
Yeah. Or it could be land. You know, sometimes the river turns and then they have to decide who gets the island or whatever it is. Those are the other cases I find interesting, when land is created and then they got to say which state controls it. And they fight like cats and dogs over these little pieces of dirt. But anyway, so the other thing that's going on here is that the Supreme Court had to take it because it was original jurisdiction, and they didn't argue about it. Some of these cases, they argue about whether it's their original jurisdiction or not and whether this falls within the constitutional claim. But in this case, there was no, they didn't go there. They said, hey, look, this is water. It's between the states. This is us. But they had never done it before. And I think that the court took an interest in this case, because they do mention it a couple of times. And Roberts, just like he likes to do with what we call the critter cases, you know how he always describes exactly where they live in like he was Marlon Perkins in the Wild Kingdom.
And, well, you're dating both of us now.
I know, exactly. But there used to be
Mutual
the show.
Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. And Marlon Perkins, who was this naturalist and zoo guy.
Zoologist or something, right?
Exactly. Explain where they were going in the veldt or wherever it was to get whatever kind of animal it was. And so Roberts likes to do that. And he does it with these water cases, too. And I just will read this very... The city of Memphis sits on the banks of the Mississippi River in the southwest corner of Tennessee. Arkansas marks the city's western border and Mississippi its southern. Hundreds of feet beneath Memphis lies one of the city's most valuable resources. Dun, dun, dun. The Middle Claiborne Aquifer. Workers discovered the aquifer in 1886 while drilling a well for the Boland Hughes Ice Company. And then he goes on about how it's used in all this. But I really get the feeling, because if you read any of the cases where, for instance, people are saying that there's no Commerce Clause jurisdiction over some kind of animal, well, it's the same thing. He likes the details of this great land. He puts them all in the case. We'll be back in a minute.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here with John Vecchione. And there was there's another development at the U.S. Supreme Court this month worth discussing. And that is that there's a case called Wynn v. United States of America. This is Wynn, W-Y-N-N, like the casino in Las Vegas. Although I don't think there's any connection between this petitioner and that family. But in any event, this is another one of these cases that NCLA has been involved in before and that we've talked about on Administrative Static before, where a lower court followed the commentary to the U.S. sentencing guidelines in increasing the length of someone's sentence. And as we have explained on here before, that is just unconstitutional. You can't have deference to the commentary of the guidelines, which never go through Congress in order to increase someone's sentence. Under the Constitution, it's the job of the legislature to pass criminal laws and to establish the penalties for criminal laws. And so you're doing an end run around Congress, an end run around bicameralism and presentment anytime that you have a sentence lengthened by something that doesn't go through Congress. And what happens with the sentencing guidelines is that the guidelines themselves do go through Congress for an up or down vote. Every time that the commission sends something over for the approval of Congress or the disapproval of Congress. But the commentary to the guidelines is not approved by Congress and isn't put in front of Congress. So we have a bunch of judges out there who are giving controlling weight to the commentary of the sentencing guidelines in increasing people's sentences as a result of this, whether it's the career criminal enhancement, which is pretty significant, or there have been some other examples of other commentary having to do with whether something is a crime of violence under state law, that kind of thing. But all these various factual matters can increase someone's sentence, but which would be fine if this were in the guidelines themselves. But when it's in the commentary to the guidelines, it's a real problem. So what's interesting about this case, you may remember, we talked about this case in the spring, John, the case of Marcus Broadway v. United States, where NCLA represented a prisoner out in Arkansas in the Eighth Circuit who had this happen to him, where his sentence was lengthened as the result of deference to the commentary. Well, Mr. Wynn had the same thing happen to him. And this case is up to the Supreme Court out of the Second Circuit, which is where there was another case among that batch of Stinson deference cases last spring. Well, actually, I think that it was filed about this time last year, but ultimately cert was denied in June or so. That case was called TAB, T-A-B-B, the United States. That came out of the Second Circuit as well. But the what's interesting about this case is that, the court denied cert. There were about a dozen or so Stinson deference cases that had worked their way up to the Supreme Court. We filed the Broadway case, I believe, maybe in December of last year. But several cases were working their way up for the court's attention. And so our thought at the time, John, was that the Supreme Court isn't going to grant all of these cases, but it probably will grant one of these cases because it's an issue that needs the Supreme Court's attention, and yet it hasn't gotten it yet. And if there was a vehicle problem, you could imagine the court thinking there was a vehicle problem with one of these cases, but surely it's not going to
explain what a vehicle problem is.
Sure, sure. So it might look at the case and say, well, you know, this case turned on more than one thing. It didn't just turn on the sentencing guidelines issue. It also turned on this other question of state law that that the lower court relied on, but that isn't part of the cert petition. And so they're sort of trying to sneak this case in, suggesting that there's only one issue that's going to change the meaning of the case. Or you might have a situation where, sure, they got the enhancement under the guidelines for item X, but they also got the enhancement under the guidelines for item Y. And even if item X goes away, it's not going to reduce their sentence because their sentence under item Y is greater. The enhancement for that is greater than the enhancement for X, for example. And those are just made up examples. I don't know that fact pattern existed in any of the cases from last term at the Supreme Court. But those are the kind of things that would make a so-called vehicle problem, where the court doesn't like to decide cases where its decision isn't going to have an impact on the parties. And it wouldn't exactly be an advisory opinion, but it would have a little bit of that flavor where the upshot of the decision might be important in the future for other parties, but it wouldn't matter that much for the parties in front of them. And the court doesn't like to decide cases in that form and fashion. They much prefer to have very live controversies with people whose own sentences in the criminal context will be affected by what they decide. But we took a careful look, NCLA took a careful look at a bunch of these cases last spring, and we have been involved with this issue at the Court of Appeals level as well. There was an en banc in the Third Circuit in a case called Nasir. There was an en banc in the Sixth Circuit. I think that was the first case that we were involved in. And I should say the Sixth Circuit covers Michigan, Ohio, Tennessee, and Kentucky. The Third Circuit covers Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey. And so all of these cases were coming up. We took a close look at them, and there were several of them that we thought looked like perfectly fine cases. We obviously thought our client, Mr. Broadway's case out of the Eighth Circuit, out of Arkansas, was one of the better, if not the best, vehicle for the court to consider this. It really didn't have any vehicle problems as far as we could tell, but there were several others that didn't either. So we fully expected the court to grant one of these cases, but as I say, it didn't do so. So it leaves you wondering, well, why not? And the speculation at the time was that the court had just decided to wash its hands of this question, because the sentencing commission itself has the ability to solve the problem. If the sentencing commission itself were to take some of these items out of the guidelines commentary, put them into the guidelines directly themselves, have Congress do an up or down vote on those items, then that would resolve the problem without the court ever getting involved. But the problem with that idea is that there are many vacancies. At least last time I checked, there were multiple vacancies on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. They did not have a quorum. And without a quorum, they're not able to do any of that. And so the idea that the court would leave it up to a body that doesn't have a quorum right now to actually solve the problem bothered me. And that I don't know whether the court was aware of that, if enough folks had made the court aware of that in the briefing last spring or not. Maybe that's something that is that has come to the court's attention in the interim. But in any event, when Mr. Nguyen filed his cert petition, the initial response was to what I believe was to waive a response or to sort of disregard the case on the assumption again that the court wasn't interested. But there was a call for response by the Supreme Court, which means that at least one of the justices, and Vec, you may know this for sure, but I think it only takes one justice to call for a response.
I believe that's true, but I don't know how often that happens. In other words, okay. I think in practice they want more than one to want to take a look at it. But I think you're right that it is one, but I just think the justices like to move together in their little blocks.
Right. So there, one person's not likely to upset the apple cart if they know that no one else is interested in seeing the response, maybe. But here, at least one justice has asked for a response. And so that drew our attention. And NCLA is going to be filing, or I should say did file this week, an amicus brief in support of the cert petition. And our hope is that the fact that one justice called for this response means that there are at least four justices who are going to be willing to grant cert and take a look at this Stinson deference question, because it really is a core due process concern. If someone's sentence is going to increase from say 5 years to 10 years, that's a huge deprivation of liberty. And that shouldn't be happening based on commentary to sentencing guidelines. That should be something that has to go through Congress in order for someone to suffer that deprivation of liberty. The other problem here, of course, is that when you're dealing with criminal penalties, typically the rule of lenity applies. And this is something that we've talked about in our bump stock cases, for example. But if there's an ambiguity in a statute, typically what you would do is the rule of lenity would come in and it would decide that ambiguity in favor of the criminal defendant.
But yeah, the rule of lenity, as we've discussed before, is that if there is an ambiguity, the tie goes to the accused, not to the government. And so you give them the lower sentence because it's not clear that the law requires a higher one. So any kind of ambiguity like that benefits the accused, not the government.
That's right. And that's the it creates an incentive for those writing the laws to be clear and specific about the conduct that they're proscribing so that those who have to follow the law know how to conform their conduct ahead of time to avoid the cut of the law, to avoid going to prison. But the problem with Stinson deference is that if you're deferring to the sentencing guidelines, to the interpretation of the sentencing commission, which is it's really a kind of, I think it sits in Article 3. It's an Article 3 authority. So you're deferring to it in place of applying the rule of lenity. And so instead of interpreting an ambiguity to favor the accused, you're interpreting or you're giving deference to an interpretation that increases the sentence of the criminal defendant, which obviously works against their interest. So it's inconsistent. It's not a good practice. It's something the court needs to take a look at. And look, here's hoping that when the United States is the case that they'll do it in. This one's gotten the court's attention of at least one justice. Let's hope it gets the attention of four and ultimately a decision from five or more to do away with this endeavor. We'll be back with more right after.